Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Welcome to Talking Business, a podcast produced in Melbourne, Australia. The podcast is available on the Acast site, my own website, the Apple Podcast Store, or wherever you go to get your podcasts. Or you can get it at the Business Acumen website at www.businessacumen.biz or at Banking Day. For the most exclusive access to leading economists and business leaders from around the world, subscribe to Talking Business from my website, leongettler.com. I am Leon Gettler. My job is to review and monitor the week's news in business, finance and economics. I bring it all to you every week. This is episode number 11 in our series for 2024, and today's date is Friday, April the 12th. First, I'll be talking to Paul Bevan, the CEO of Melbourne-based agri-food startup Magic Valley, with its development of cultivated beef and pork. And I'll be talking to AMP Capital Chief Economist Shane Oliver about Australia's latest inflation figures. But first, let's talk to Paul Bevan.
Well, Paul, what is the demand for cultivated pork and cultivated beef?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. Obviously, you know, there's not a lot of regulated cultivated meat products available to purchase at the moment. So we don't have, you know, existing, you know, sales figures to be able to go off. But I think what we can identify as a really good proxy is the amount of consumers that are looking for, you know, an ethical, sustainable food product when it comes to their decisions around the food choices that they're making. We've seen in recent years, you know, a real boom in at least first-time sales of plant-based meat substitutes, which are really pitched as, you know, sustainable, ethical alternatives to traditionally farmed meat products. The difference there, I guess, is that those plant-based meat substitutes are they're not real meat, so they're not animal meat, and they're never going to be able to, you know, replicate, you know, the molecular structure of animal meat. And so what we've seen there is, you know, some really large first-time purchases of those products, which to me indicates there's a really strong demand for an ethical, sustainable solution or alternative to a traditionally farmed product. But because they haven't lived up to those, you know, I guess expectations in terms of taste, texture, mouthfeel, that those sales have dropped off. But to me, that's the biggest indicator that there's an appetite for a product that is ethical and sustainable, but is identical to a traditionally farmed meat product that consumers have been eating for, you know, hundreds and thousands of years. So for me, that's the strongest indicator. Obviously, you know, we've done some, you know, research in terms of the interest in cultivated meat product. There's been extensive research done, well, globally, really, in terms of potential purchasing by consumers. And they show, those surveys show that the vast majority of consumers are very likely or extremely likely to purchase cultivated meat, you know, as part of their shop. But also, when the benefits are explained, you know, whether that's from a sustainability side or a nutritional side or the animal ethics side, that once that is explained, consumers have also said that they're willing to pay more than traditionally farmed meat for those products. So, look, that's all well and good, and I'm sure you'll agree, you know, the proof will be in the pudding, you know, once the products come to market, you know, and we're really hopeful that that demand will be there. And I guess the other really important point to note is that in terms of the research that's been done, consumers in the younger demographic have been shown to be more open to accept food technology in terms of, you know, how their food is produced, and also cultivated meat on the whole. And they've shown a real propensity, you know, to make their decisions around sustainability issues or ethical issues when it does come to their food choices.
What actually goes into, say, cultivated pork?
Yeah, so basically with any of our cultivated meat product and the pork, for example, we basically take a small sampling of cells from the ear of an animal, either a scraping or a small punch biopsy. So we obtain some of those skin cells. We then take those cells into the lab, and in the lab, we add some nutrients to those cells. So, you know, amino acids, glucose, et cetera. And we reprogram those skin cells into stem cells. Now, from there, they're known as induced pluripotent stem cells. From those cells, we can create or direct them to become muscle, fat, bone, connective tissue, blood, whatever we direct them to become. And we have those in containers that are called bioreactors, and we add those nutrients to those cells, grow up the muscle, grow up the fat, etc., and then combine them together to make a real meat product. So we're basically replicating what would happen inside the animal's body, but just doing it inside the controlled environment in the lab.
So how long does that process take?
Yeah, so there's a maturation process of the cells. Depends at what point you start from, but it's around a few weeks at the moment for the initial products that we're producing. It differs, obviously, across the tissue type a little bit, but yeah, just a few weeks.
I would imagine a dish, cultivated pork or cultivated beef dish would cost more than your standard pork or meat dish that you get at a butcher shop or supermarket.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question that comes up quite a lot. At the moment, obviously, you know, we're at, you know, very small scale, or I mean the industry as a whole, quite small scale in terms of, you know, where we're looking to get to. But at the moment, for the cost for us to produce, let's say, a kilo of our, you know, initial cultivated pork product, which is a mincemeat product. In Australian dollars, we're around, you know, $50 a kilo to produce that. By the time we get to, you know, our first production facility, you know, we're aiming to have that cost at around $5 a kilo. And I think pork at the moment is around sort of that $16 a kilo, you know, give or take, mark at the moment. So at the moment, it is more expensive to produce. But once we reach scale, we think we'll be able to do it even cheaper than traditionally farmed meat. Well, what the price is now anyway. And, you know, we'd expect that the cost of traditionally farmed meat to continue to rise. To be fair, obviously there's going to be, you know, increased demand from increased population. You know, we've only got a limited supply of, you know, land, water and resources. So, you know, we project that those prices will continue to go up and the price of cultivated meat will continue to come down.
What does a dish of cultivated pork taste like to the pork dish I might buy in a supermarket?
Well, it tastes identical is the simple answer to that. It tastes identical. We've done some, you know, external taste tests recently and the feedback has been sensational. Yeah. So the similarities between the product really are indistinguishable because molecularly they're the same. The key benefit, or one of the key benefits that we have in terms of the taste, texture, mouthfeel, nutritional profile of the product is that because we do develop the products in a, you know, controlled sterile environment in the lab, we can actually reduce the amount of saturated fat, for example. We can add in, you know, additional omega-3s or fortify with vitamins and minerals as well. So taste-wise, it should be identical, but the nutritional profile should be even better. So, you know, we'd like to think that cultivated products will be even better than traditionally farmed products.
And healthier,
exactly. There's absolutely the potential for them to be much healthier.
And how does this fit in with the sustainability of the farm product?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. In terms of sustainability, there's been studies done on a complete replacement of conventional or traditionally farmed meat products with cultivated meat products. And that looks like a huge reduction across the board, particularly in greenhouse gas emissions, over 90% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions, over 90% reduction in land use, and around a 70% reduction in water use as well. So obviously, you know, at the moment, in terms of, you know, traditionally farmed products or traditional animal agriculture, I think at the moment the projections for greenhouse gas emissions that come from, you know, livestock production, it's around 17 or 18% of total global greenhouse gas emissions. So, you know, if we were able to, you know, reduce that portion by, you know, over 90%, you know, that's going to have a massive impact on sustainability moving forward.
But you are confident the demand is there for this?
Absolutely, absolutely. There's particularly, we've got people coming to us already requesting to purchase the products, requesting bulk orders, you know, from retail groups looking to stock the product. And you know, we have no doubt that the demand is there for the product. But obviously, you know, we have to get the product into consumers' hands, and the, as the saying goes, the proof will be in the pudding then.
And so where would you be selling this through? Would you be selling it through supermarkets or standard butcher shops? Where would you be selling it?
Yeah, initially and at smaller scale production, we'd be looking to distribute the products through food service or restaurant businesses. Obviously, once we get to larger production capacity, the goal really is to be selling in supermarkets, where the majority of people buy their meat. Butcher shops as well, but primarily through supermarkets and retail outlets, and for the product to be a widely available ingredient, either in a raw form or in a finished product, as mainstream as possible.
Okay, and final question, when do you expect this cultivated pork and cultivated beef will actually hit the market?
Yeah, we're aiming for regulatory approval in Australia of our products by the end of 2024. So we'd expect to see products available either end of 2024 or in 2025.
Right, okay. So we'll watch that with a lot of interest.
Absolutely. A little way to go, but we're not too far away now.
Well, Paul, we'll watch it with fascination, and thank you very much for your time.
Very much, Sam.
And now let's talk to AMP Capital Chief Economist Shane Oliver.
Headline inflation stayed put at 3.4%, equaling the December and January prints. Does that mean progress in inflation?
I wouldn't say that it stalled. In fact, the inflation numbers are actually lower than expected. The market was looking for a rise in inflation to 3.5%. We thought it could have increased to 3.7% in the event. It actually remained at the low levels we've seen for the last couple of months. The RBA's expectation for inflation this quarter is 3.5%. So we're coming in around 3.4%. In fact, once you allow for March, even if you get a bit of a rise in the monthly number for March, the quarterly number could come in, or the year-end number could come in around 3.2%. So it's quite possible that we're going to see inflation for the quarter as a whole come in below the RBA's expectations. And I think that would be very good news. You've got to bear in mind that these are annual data, and they're affected not only by what happens in the most recent months, but also what happens a year ago. And a year ago, the monthly inflation rates were quite low. And that was after a huge spike in November, December of 2022, when inflation got to around 8%. So what we're doing is we're dropping off those lower monthly inflation increases a year ago and replacing them with numbers today. But the good news is that the inflation numbers are still staying low. And so we're not seeing a rise in inflation. We're just seeing it tread sideways. But I think as we go through the rest of the year, we'll continue to see inflation come in lower than expected. And we see the inflation rate falling below 3% by the time we get to the September quarter.
But these figures didn't show services inflation. What do we make of services inflation?
But it did actually include more services. This is the common thing that people say, we can't look at the monthly numbers because they don't have the full suite of services numbers. But this, the February survey does actually include a lot of prices on services in February. That is a month where many of them are surveyed. Not all of them, but a whole bunch of them were surveyed. For example, we were concerned very much about hairdressing and personal grooming. That's still an issue. That was up 2.1%, but it was surveyed in the month of February. Dental services, which the RBA governor was concerned about, wasn't included, but things like pets and related products were included. They were down 1.3%. Obviously, education, which is a service, it had sharp rises. So, were it not for that, the numbers would have gone down. But a lot of services were included in the month. But obviously, we get a fuller reading when we come into the March figures.
Right. So there are pockets of inflation that we should be watching out for.
Well, services remains the key pocket to watch out for. Services inflation on an annual basis did actually edge up slightly in the month of February, and even though goods price inflation is still falling. So services is still the big one to watch, and that's obviously very dependent on what happens to the labour market. If the labour market continues to remain as tight as it has been lately, that obviously puts upwards pressure on wages, which is a big driver of services inflation. unfortunately, so far anyway, goods prices have been doing the heavy lifting. Mind you, it worked on the way up as well, that the initial surge in inflation was due to goods. Services then followed, and now you're starting to see it work the same way on the way down. Goods prices have come well and truly off the boil. Services inflation still has a bit further to go to get down to levels that the RBA would be fully comfortable with. But the upshot of all of that means that, well, there's no meeting in April. The next meeting is in May. The Reserve Bank, I think, by then will still be cautious. They may still be cautious into the middle of the year. We think there is a good chance they will cut in June, given the way the inflation numbers are coming in less than expected. But obviously, there is a risk that they may remain cautious out to August or September, in which case, a rate cut could be 6 months away. But we think there is a strong case to start from around June. It's a similar story in central banks around the world. Overnight, we heard from the Swedish central bank flagging an inclination or a tendency to move towards a cut in May or June. This came on the back of similar guidance coming out of the US and Europe, particularly regarding June. So my feeling is that that's the direction it's going in, but you can obviously have some slippage in the timing and that rate cuts could get delayed.
Another risk is wages. I mean, unions are now pushing for a 5% increase.
They certainly are. So this is the increase in minimum and award wages. The Fair Work Commission case regarding that will be getting underway now. It affects about 22% of the workforce. There's about 1% or just less of the workforce on the minimum wage, which is something like $23.40 an hour or something like that. Could be wrong on the decimal place there, but that last year rose by 8.65%. The award rates of pay, that affects workers in something like 21% of total employment. Last year, that rose 5.75%. The unions are pushing for a 5% rise, which, if granted, would be a fairly heavy number, given that inflation is well below that. And last year, we had such huge rises. I suspect that the more likely scenario will be something more in line with inflation, which takes us to around 3.5 or 4, depending on which inflation number they look at. In which case, if you get 3.5 to 4, you could argue that is consistent with expectation for wages growth anyway. And I don't think that would be a major threat. But it's obviously something to keep an eye on and something the Reserve Bank will be watchful in relation to. I think they probably will get that decision prior to the June meeting, which won't be, or the second half of June. They won't have that decision by the May meeting. So that may be something they could wait out for. So wages are still certainly a risk. We still have a fairly tight labour market, even though it has been cooling down.
The other issue too is that in July, people are going to get tax cuts.
That's right. The rejigged stage three tax cuts, rejigging of those tax cuts added some risk. So if you look at the dollar amount of them, it's the same. So if you just mechanically work out, well, how much is going back into the economy that wouldn't have otherwise been there, there's no change. But what has changed is that the skew of those tax cuts has been spread more evenly across or spread to include more workers. And that means a greater portion of low middle incomers get tax cuts on top of the ones they got in the stage one and stage two phases of the tax cuts, which has been going on for years now. And so you might see more spending coming out of that. So that's obviously something that creates a bit of uncertainty going into the middle of the year. So, you know, you can make an argument, well, inflation is coming down. It's heading in the right direction. The Reserve Bank doesn't have to wait till they get inflation bang on the target on a year-ended basis, as long as we see several quarters or so of numbers in line with achieving that target. And you could argue, well, CPI was 0.6 in the December quarter. Looks like this quarter will be 0.5. Annualized that, you get 2.2%. So inflation in the last 6 months looks like it's been running around level consistent with or below the target. So you could argue, well, the Reserve Bank might be in a position to ease. Flip side, though, is the Reserve Bank still worried about services issues with wages growth continuing, the stage three tax cuts, and last week or the week or so before's financial stability review painted a relatively benign picture, and the economy is still growing. So the Reserve Bank might argue, well, we're in no hurry, we'll just wait and see. And then that could delay it. So that's why I think there is still a lot of uncertainty around when these tax cuts will come, even though I think that's the direction we're heading in.
But certainly might give the Reserve Bank pause to reconsider maybe in August?
It could. It certainly could, that they could wait longer. Mind you, that would be a repeat of the same mistake they made 2 and a bit years ago, when perhaps they should have been raising interest rates earlier in response to the pickup in inflation that was occurring at the end of 2021 and start of 2022. They delayed and delayed and delayed, waiting for more confidence that it was going to be sustained. And then, of course, by the time that happened, inflation ran away and got as high as 8%. You could argue they may risk doing the same thing now, waiting and waiting and waiting, even though inflation is falling, but waiting for more confidence that it's going to be sustained, leave rates too high for too long, and then you end up with inflation eventually ending up well below target. So that is a risk in all of this that the Reserve Bank has to balance, and that's part of the narrow path they keep referring to, not wanting to maintain monetary policy tight enough for long enough to get inflation down, by the same token not doing so much that it plunges the economy into recession. So that balancing act remains in place.
Well, listening to Michelle Bullock, I mean, she sounds quite hawkish on inflation.
She does, but she also, for the first time in a long time, they've moved to a neutral bias on interest rates. So for a long time, they're either raising rates and saying, yeah, likelihood is we'll have to raise rates again, or you know, most recent commentary was we can't rule that.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Wrote this down, we can't rule out another rate hike, whereas now they're saying they're not ruling anything in or out, which sounds a lot more symmetrical than it has been suggesting. And she even said that they are getting more confidence. That said, I don't think we should rely on the Reserve Bank actually telling us what they're going to do. Precisely. They did a bit of that back in 2021. Governor Lowe said, no, we don't expect any rate hike until 2024. That turned out to be going too far. I think they've learned their lesson from that. So we can't expect the Reserve Bank, given got burnt back then, to issue the same sort of guidance this time around. It's just all in degrees and trying to assess how their language has changed a little bit, which it has. It has softened a bit, but obviously we're still not there yet.
So we'll wait and see whether there'll be a rate cut this year. And you're expecting that it will be sometime? When do you expect a rate cut?
Well, our base case is June, not the next meeting, the one after, which is about 3 weeks, three months away. But obviously I'd have to concede the risk is very high that may be delayed to August or September, which I think is the consensus amongst economists. There's a bunch like ourselves saying it could be a bit earlier. Another bunch saying, well, not till 2025, but the consensus was around, when I last looked, was for September. August was 50-50, and the money market was fairly similar. The money market seems to be waxing and waning as to whether it's going to be August or September. I'm reasonably confident that's the direction we're heading in. I guess from an investment point of view, I mean, it's quite clear if you're a homeowner with a mortgage struggling to make the payments, then the sooner the better. From an investment point of view, it's a bit of a mixed bag, because if rate cuts are delayed simply because inflation's falling and looks okay, but the economy is still solid, then that's not necessarily a bad situation. And that is what you've seen in the US all this year. We started the year off, market was looking for 7 rate cuts from the Fed. Now that's down to 3 or 4. I think around 3 was the latest. So, but the market has still gone to new highs and is up, you know, give or take 10% year to date, because they may not get the same number of rate cuts, but the economy is stronger and earnings growth is stronger. So as long as the reason for an absence of rate cuts remains relatively positive as opposed to negative, then you know, share markets can still do okay.
Well, Shane, it's been great talking to you again, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Leon.
So what's happening in the news? Well, in an important report, the IMF has found Australian households are more sensitive to changes in interest rates than virtually any other consumers globally because of the dominance of variable rate mortgages, high levels of household debt, and lax lending rules. In new research on the effects of monetary policy on housing markets, the Washington-based IMF found significant differences across economies on the potency of interest rate changes. The authors found that monetary policy was stronger in economies where fixed rate mortgages were not common, home buyers were more leveraged, national household debt was high, housing supply was more restricted, and house prices were overvalued. Not surprisingly, Australia was near the top on almost all of those metrics except for overvaluation. Countries such as Australia and Japan appear to have stronger housing channels of monetary policy transmission, with low shares of fixed rate mortgages, less restricting loan-to-value limits, high household debt, only to some extent Japan, and a somewhat elevated proportion of the population living in housing supply restricted areas, the IMF said. The report showed that more than 80% of the Australian mortgage market is typically priced at variable interest rates, meaning most homeowners see their mortgage rates adjust soon after the RBA changes the cash rate. Only Chile and South Africa, where fixed rate lending is essentially non-existent, had a greater proportion of variable loans. In an economy like Australia, dominated by variable rate lending, a 100 basis point increase in interest rates caused consumption to fall by 0.5% over 2 years, the IMF estimated. But in an economy dominated by fixed rates such as the United States, consumption increased by 1.5% since the majority of households did not feel the pinch of rising borrowing costs. Australia's 112% household debt to GDP ratio was second highest in the world to Switzerland, according to the IMF. In countries with above average household debt, ratios like Australia, a 100 basis point increase in interest rates caused house prices to fall by 5% over 2 years. In countries with low levels of household debt, the price decline was a more modest 2%. The IMF said Australia's sensitivity to interest rate changes meant the RBA and the government needed to closely monitor economic conditions to ensure the central bank had not doled out a larger than necessary amount of pain to the household sector. And medical glove maker Ansell is expanding into new markets like medical device makers, university laboratories and manufacturers of semiconductors and pharmaceuticals, and increasing its product offerings to include protective clothing and safety eyewear for industrial use by striking a deal to acquire US giant Kimberly-Clark Corporation's personal protective equipment business under the Chemtech and KleenGuard brands for US $640 million, that's 974 million Aussie in cash. The company will raise $400 million in capital through a fully underwritten placement priced at $22.45 a share and aims to bolster its balance sheet further with up to $65 million from a share purchase plan. The integration of the business will generate US $10 million in annual synergies by the third year of ownership. Ansell Chief Executive Neil Salmon said the company had been eyeing the Kimberly-Clark protective equipment business for a decade and had to move fast when the target began a competitive sale process a few months ago after many years of being an unwilling seller. The deal makes sense for Ansell. Chemtech makes gloves and other safety equipment for scientific laboratories, and KleenGuard specialises in protective clothing and safety eyewear for industrial use. Mr. Salmon said the acquisition would broaden Ansell's portfolio of products in the scientific and pharmaceuticals industries, where customers include medical device makers, university laboratories, and manufacturers of semiconductors and pharmaceuticals. And the Albanese government will push insurers to cut costs for households that take steps to reduce their risks amid soaring double-digit premium growth that is expected to continue in 2024. This coincides with Jarden Equities analysts predicting home insurance premiums to rise more than 15% in the year to June 30, before moderating to 5% in 2024-25. Despite the losses in home coverage, insurers have recorded healthy after-tax profits of $7.3 billion over the past four financial years. The National Emergency Management Agency is building a database of validated and evidence-supported steps people could take to reduce risks from floods, bushfires and cyclones. Steps could include roof replacement, upgrading garage doors and frames, boosting window protection, tying down external structures such as sheds, and replacing flimsy hollow doors. The database will be released by the end of 2024. Labor MP Daniel Molino, who is chairing a parliamentary inquiry into the insurance industry, backed discounts for homeowners who take steps to protect their properties against damage from natural disasters. The inquiry will hold public hearings in the flood-prone areas of Brisbane on Tuesday, Logan on Wednesday, and Lismore on Thursday. Submissions to Dr. Molino's inquiry suggest few insurance companies offer premium reductions for mitigation efforts, but a new industry disruptor, Honey Insurance, is looking to attract customers by doing just that. Honey offers its customers an 8% discount on premiums if they use in-occupied homes in Queensland that had certified cyclone mitigation upgrades under the Household Resilience Program. It also offers lower premiums for households in flood-prone areas that raise their floors. But Dr. Molino said it was also crucial local governments did not approve new developments in areas with an inappropriate level of natural disaster risk. His inquiry is exploring calls for the government to expand its taxpayer-based reinsurance pool for the riskiest homes in return for local councils not approving building in high-risk areas. The Financial Rights Legal Centre and consumer group Choice also back premium discounts linked to mitigation and want insurer decisions to be reviewable by the Australian Financial Complaints Authority. Reducing risk where possible is a vital response to living with more frequent and intense extreme weather, the pair said in a joint submission to the Senate inquiry. They said premiums need to be commensurate with reduced risk and insurers should commit to multi-year discounted premiums. A single year of reduced insurance costs is not commensurate to raising a house or replacing a roof. And it's kind of good news for supermarkets. An independent review has rejected the forced breakup of Coles and Woolworths. The review by economist Craig Emerson found the populist idea, backed by the Coalition and advocated by the Greens, lacked credibility and could trigger store closures and job losses. The not-so-good news is that new penalties would require updating the ACCC with legislation. This sets up a Barney in the Senate with the Coalition Greens, who could move to amend the bill to include supermarket divestiture powers they've called for. Emerson has proposed supermarket suppliers abide by a mandatory code of conduct backed by stiff penalties of up to $5.2 billion for the largest chains. These fines are no small matter. For Woolworths, with turnover of $50.2 billion in 2024, that could mean a maximum whack of $5.2 billion, which could take a significant chunk out of their sales. For Coles, the maximum would be $3.8 billion, which would slice into last sales of $41.4 billion. It would be $1.3 billion for Aldi and $880 million for IGA supplier Metcash. Under draft recommendations, supermarkets could be asked to sign on to a mediation that would allow suppliers to seek awards of up to $5 million. They could also be blocked from negotiating out-of-code contracts. Dr. Emerson found the voluntary code covering the supermarkets was not effective. His report said it lacked fines and there were power imbalances, which left suppliers too scared to challenge the two giants that control 65% of the market. This voluntary food and grocery code of conduct applies to Coles, Woolworths, Aldi and Metcash, and sets out minimum obligations and behavioural standards for their conduct with suppliers. The Emerson Review seeks to change that. Woolworths wants the beefed up rules to be extended to other major retailers, including global heavyweights Amazon, Costco, along with Bunnings and Chemist Warehouse. The federal government on Monday offered its in principle support to Dr. Emerson's recommendations, but will consult with industry before a final report is delivered by the end of June. And Treasury Wine Estate Chief Executive Tim Ford said the company will decide within months whether to demerge or sell off its less expensive brands, with the trend towards more premium products only accelerating. A demerger would concentrate Treasury's efforts on its premium wines business and on its lucrative Penfolds label, which makes more money than cheaper wines. Treasury knows that drinkers around the world are increasingly steering clear of wines in the under $10 to $15 a bottle price segment and are opting for higher priced brands. The demerger decision will be made by December. The wine brands that could potentially be demerged into a separate entity or offered for sale sit on the group's Treasury Premium Brands unit. They include Wynns, Pepperjack, Lindeman's, Seppelt, Rawson's Retreat, Squealing Pig and Wolf Blass. Some of the other mid or lower priced wine brands also included in the review include Sterling Vineyards, 19 Crimes, Mature, St. Hubert's. The company is weighing up how far it might go in shifting its business to luxury wines. It classifies these as bottled wines selling for $30 or more. If Treasury chooses to demerge or sell its mid-market and lower-priced brands business, it will end up with a wine business with a much heavier reliance on luxury wines priced above $30 per bottle. About 75% of the company's profits come from the Penfolds business and a luxury wine portfolio in the United States. So a demerger would take Treasury where the money is. And Australian companies are better preparing themselves for attacks by cyber criminal gangs, leading to a dramatic drop in extortion demands, according to a major security firm. BGH Capital-backed CyberCX, whose response team has been on the ground helping deal with some of the country's high-profile cyber attacks, found ransom payments fell 50% based on a sample of 100 major incidents handled by the firm. Why is this happening? Because there's been a growing understanding of ransomware and hardening of defences against attacks to reduce the severity. This is playing a major role, said Hamish Krebs, Executive Director of Digital Forensics and Incident Response at CyberCX. Criminal gangs use ransomware to try to overwhelm companies so they're dead in the water, giving them no option but pay a ransom, and quickly, he said. Now, he added, there are various types of technical controls. High-profile attacks, including on Medibank Private, which CyberCX worked on, Optus, Latitude, Nine Entertainment and HWL Ebsworth, have put cybersecurity to front of mind for companies and the public. CyberCX, in its 2023 year in review, recorded a rise in the number of companies that did not pay and found their data was not leaked publicly. Around 53% of companies that refused to pay did not found their data leaked online, compared with 46% in 2023. And Seven's investigative program, Spotlight, will make its return on Sunday, April the 14th. That's despite concerns that the beleaguered current affairs shows could be hit by public backlash over scandalous claims that emerged about the M Network last year. That sent Spotlight into crisis management, with Spotlight staff discussing the show's future in recent days. They reckon if 960 Minutes survived the Beirut scandal in 2016, when four Nine staffers were arrested in Lebanon on allegations of child abduction, then Spotlight could weather the storm surrounding the Bruce Lehrman interview. Still, some Seven insiders say they are shocked that Spotlight was returning so soon after allegations that Seven reimbursed ex-producer Taylor Auerbach and Mr. Lehrman for expenses relating to the use of prostitutes and drugs. Seven denies it paid for prostitutes and drugs for either the men. Mr. Lehrman denies he was with Mr. Auerbach on the night in November 2022 when the payments for the service of two Thai masseuses was allegedly put on a network credit card. Federal Court Judge Michael Lee is expected to hand down his findings in the defamation action brought by Mr. Lehrman against Network 10 and Lisa Wilkinson on Monday, and his assessments of Seven's conduct in relation to its handling of Mr. Lehrman will be closely scrutinised by Seven executives. It's understood Spotlight executive producer Mark Llewellyn had not faced any disciplinary action over the revelations aired in court last week, and the network is standing by him. That's at least for now. It would be a mistake to describe the revelations of the past week as a one-off. The Lehrman Spotlight scandal is the latest in a thick binder of morally questionable actions at Seven over the last decade, and begs whether the judgment of its leader, topped by chairman and largest shareholder Kerry Stokes, is out of step with modern society. Auerbach's allegations of Seven paying for cocaine and sex workers, which Seven denies, paint a newsroom crossing the line of what is acceptable, leaving the societal norms far in the rearview mirror. CEO James Warburton has already announced he'll be leaving Seven West Media by the end of June, with the industry anticipating a May exit. If the judge rules against Lehrman, the biggest favour Warburton can do for his colleagues and boss Kerry Stokes is to clear his desk. And China's investment in Australia continues to fall as Beijing takes a more strategic view of offshore spending and its companies exhibit caution about Australia's tighter foreign investment law. Why is this happening? Because for the first time, the share of China's offshore direct investment is going to be the so-called Belt and Road Initiative country, which has exceeded 20% of its global ODI. The latest report from KPMG Australia and University of Sydney shows that new Chinese investment in Australia in 2023 was down to its second lowest level since 2006. It fell by 36% to $1.34 billion in 2023, compared with $2.1 billion in 2022, with healthcare overtaking mining as a key industry, the second lowest only after COVID-19 in 2021. This is a far cry from the heady days of 2009, when new China's investment in Australia topped $21 billion. There are only 11 transactions recorded in 2023, which was the same as the COVID-19 year of 2021, and only a fraction of the more than 100 deals in one peak year. The annual KPMG Sydney University Demystifying Chinese Investment in Australia report analyses China's overseas direct investment ODI into Australia for the calendar year January to December 2023. The fall in investment in Australia came despite a pickup in China's overall non-financial direct investment offshore in 2023 during the year, rising by more than 8% to US $130 billion. Australia was once the biggest single destination for offshore Chinese investment, but it now prefers the US and countries linked with its Belt and Road Investment Initiative. This has included investments in Indonesia's nickel processing sector, which has reduced world prices and challenged Australia to... And the boss of a failed Queensland tourism investment scheme is facing a lengthy time in jail after he was arrested in Melbourne and charged with four counts of dishonest conduct amid an escalating stoush with Australia's corporate regulator. In a case brought to court by the Australian Securities Investments, James McWhinney was charged with dealing relating to IPO Wealth, an unregistered investment scheme promoted by his company, Mayfair. Mayfair burst to public prominence after Mr. Winnie announced a $1.6 billion redevelopment plan for Dunk Island and Mission Beach in far north Queensland in late 2019. Mr. McWhinney snapped up a number of homes across the coastal community under the Mayfair plans, with plans to turn Mission Beach into a tourism hotspot. This came after an advertising campaign touting Mayfair's bank-like investment schemes, raising $210 million from 128 investors. But ASIC pursued Mr. McWhinney over the scheme, alleging Mayfair engaged in misleading and deceptive conduct and made false or misleading representations when promoting investment note schemes. Four criminal charges against Mr. McWhinney end the battle between the corporate regulator and the boss of Mayfair. Each charge carries a maximum sentence of 15 years. And that's it for this week. And next week I'll be talking to Justin Seskin, CEO and co-founder of The Dom, Australia's newest online retail outlet. Justin is particularly poised to speak about how more young Aussies are turning to outlet shopping to reduce both landfill waste and price point. And I'll be talking to EY economist Sherelle Murphy about Australia's inflation figures. For the most exclusive access to leading economists and business leaders from around the world, subscribe to Talking Business from my website, leongetler.com. If you like Talking Business, please leave us a review with Apple Podcasts. Thank you in advance. In the meantime, you catch me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and YouTube. And if you want, leave a comment. If you want to contact me, email me at leon@leongetler.com. I answer all emails. Wishing you all a safe and healthy week, and looking forward to bringing you Talking Business next week.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.